It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley, your host, and this is episode 36, Nightmare Alley. We're talking about that movie from 1947 called Nightmare Alley, starring Tyrone Power, Helen Walker, Colleen Gray, some other fun people, and directed by Edmund Goulding. But before we go any further than that, I need to introduce my panelists for this evening's show, beginning with Annette Weirstra. Hello.
Hello, Shelley. I believe I can see you holding a wallet.
Exactly right. How did you know?
Just a magic.
Next up, let's see. I divine from the cards and from the picture on Zoom. It's Nathan Alderman.
Hi. Sorry, I'm late. I had to floss after beheading that chicken with my teeth, man.
That's a good plan. Well, friends, we are in for a delightful time, beheaded chickens and being able to do spiritual tricks, all part of this movie. An interesting movie. Nightmare Alley was from 20th Century Fox. Tyrone Power, like the biggest star on the lot, he gets out of the Navy and he goes, hey, I want to make something really different. And because he's Tyrone Power, he got to do it. And that's what we're going to talk about. It is variously described as a noir. I guess you could just call it a drama as well. I mean, it's noir in its appearance, but there are no gumshoes and guys with heaters and mobsters, except Mike Mazurki's in it. So, you know, that's as close to noir as you get. Let me throw it to you guys and get your first impressions. What did you think of this movie? Neither of you seen it before. So it was like, all right, Shelley, I'm watching what you tell me to do. So tell me what you thought.
Colleen Gray made a heck of an impression.
She did. She was very beautiful.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was bleak and grimy and gorgeously shot. And I love that they shot it with a really depressing ending. And the studio boss came back and said, no, this ending's too depressing. You have to make a happy ending. So they found a way to make a happy ending that is even more depressing.
I know, right?
I'd only seen Tyrone Power in The Mark of Zorro. And I love the strong Bruce Campbell vibes he gave off here, from the slicked back hair to the way he calls women baby all the time.
Yeah, and it's funny, though. He's still Tyrone Power. Like, whatever happens to him in the movie, whatever he does, he's still a pretty guy. I don't feel like you have to watch as many Tyrone Power movies as I have, but it was sort of like, it's Tyrone Power in there. That's weird.
The script is doing a lot of work for him. I felt like he was probably doing his best, but this is not an outstanding performance. He has a few moments of really good facial acting, but mostly, like his character, he's just sort of coasting along and letting the script kind of prop him up.
There's a lot to that. Annette, what did you think?
Well, like you said earlier, I was sort of expecting a noir, and so I was waiting for the murder. So I was like, when is someone going to get murdered in this? And that doesn't really happen, or it's not a focus of anything. So, you know, but I did thoroughly enjoy his whole magic act, and got really obsessed with trying to figure out why you're trying to figure out the code. There is no code. And the way they were, you know, communicating to each other about what their shtick, you know. And I also just love the way that the beginning was broadcast, or the ending was broadcast at the beginning, with the whole scene of like, who is that guy and why is he in such a terrible position? And I'm like, I wonder what's going to happen.
They've got a sign over the opening credits, the body of a man, the soul of a beast. It's like, we put it in neon, but, you know, come on.
Just
you
in case do anybody might be missing it, right?
I feel like
lacks
it's not
subtlety
subtle
in a few places.
It's not subtle.
But they do, in its favor, they do a good job of setting up at the beginning just how horrible that fate is, so that even if you know it's inevitable, it just adds to the mounting sense of dread as you go through the movie.
Yeah, and it's not moralized. If this movie had been made, because Edmund Goulding, who made this movie, I was going to talk about him a little later, but the things he's known most for are in the 30s, like Grand Hotel and Dark Victory and stuff. And if this movie had been made sort of in his heyday in the 30s, under the MGM studios particularly, there would have been some imperative to moralize. I mean, bad stuff happens and Tyrone Power doesn't end up well, but you don't have people shaking their fingers at him going, see, it just kind of happens, and you're left to go, oh, well, he probably made some bad choices in his life.
Yeah, it's not like the mind reader with Warren Williams that we did earlier, where he the main character has a monologue at the end where he goes, "What I am doing is a fake and a phony. You're all suckers for falling for it." Nope, it just lets stuff happen.
Right, and there's a point in the middle too where I was trying to decide, has he fallen for his own bull, or is it just that there's so much going on, so many balls in the air, he's trying to, and he has some remorse for allowing Pete to die, that he's kind of messed up in his head. But like, there's a brief moment when you're like, does he actually believe it? And especially when we get toward the end, when he's with the hobos, it's like, wait, does he actually believe that he has this ability? And are we meant to believe that maybe he does? And then, of course, he pulls right out of that and goes, it's so easy. Everybody has a mother.
I also think it was not super predictable, even though you knew where it was going. So that journey to get there was unpredictable. And I thought that the whole medium shtick was really relevant. Like, because, you know, we still see so much of that sort of thing happening, especially when you get to the point where he partners with Lilith and they have their little, like, cold plus hot reading of people. And I was just like, oh, so like, I thought that was sort of a modern thing that was happening, but apparently this thing, you know, even though I know the whole mediums and everything has been going along, so, but it just, that to me felt really modern because this still happens. And I love the layers of con upon con upon con. Like, yeah, you all deserve it.
That's what made it work, I think, because if you boil the story down, I mean, the guy is using all the people in his life as stepping stones to grow his con and become more successful, and then eventually he will fall. But you're right, the actual beats of it are unpredictable, and the sort of layering of and who's going to be his accomplice and for what reason is a little unpredictable. Like, that's what keeps you watching in spite of some of the weaknesses of the script and certainly of some of the performances, although I liked a lot of them.
I think Stan Carlisle, Power's main character, is a really interesting character because going in, I expected him to be a cold-blooded schemer, and he's not. He's kind of dumb, but he's not immoral. He's amoral, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. makes him very interesting to watch. He honestly, like, he admits it at one point. He's like, I just go along and just always look out for myself. I don't know why. He's not introspective. He's not thoughtful. He's not like plotting five steps ahead to do terrible things. He's just taking advantage of stuff as it comes his way, and he doesn't care if someone, you know, as long as he doesn't do something too terribly bad, he doesn't care if someone gets hurt. It's really interesting that when he accidentally gives Pete the wrong alcohol, you know, the poisonous wood alcohol instead of slightly less poisonous grain alcohol, he feels bad. He feels guilty. And like, he deals with it in the worst possible way, like by blaming others and being a jerk to others. But that stuck with me, that he's not a heartless monster. He's just a lazy dude who's happy to mooch off whatever opportunity comes his way and look out for number one.
Well, and even though when he's interacting with Pete before, we know that Pete has something that he wants, and it's kind of telegraphed as like, some way Stan is going to take what Pete has, whether it's his wife and the code, and he's going to make use of it. And either Pete has to be literally gotten out of the way, or he has to just be, you know, put out of the way in terms of his interactions with the Joan Blondell character. And so you're thinking, oh, he's going to kill him. He's going to kill him. And he does. And it ends up being what happens to Pete ends up being the source of the only moment of, like, you know, panic and disconcertedness that Stan has, because first he's blaming others, and then later on when he has the flashback because the masseuse puts the alcohol on him, you know, that's the action that he, the only action that he really reflects on.
But it changes nothing, really.
Right.
Like, he doesn't learn from it. He just is like, oh, that was really bad of me, I guess. Oops. And then he still steals, like, he still gets the code. And he also, just to build on what Nathan was saying, it's like, he doesn't even originally come up with any of his cons. He just takes a con of someone else and, like, tweaks it a little bit and then tweaks it a little more and takes, you know, it's like, he's not even original. He just takes everybody else's ideas and just manages to be successful with it.
And he's got the gift of gab, but partly because I think there are flaws in the script and partly because I think they were trying to make it sort of vague. There's no real consistency about it. He doesn't feel particularly mesmerizing in terms of all the little soliloquies he gives. And so you're just sort of like, okay. And I thought it was fascinating that it's supposed to be spiritually or religiously based because he went to this he lived in this orphanage where they beat him up most of the week and then they sent him to church. So supposedly he got sort of the patter and the biblical references. As he says to a character later on in the movie, you know, I never mentioned God. I didn't say, which seems to be really important to him. And he's not using sort of stock biblical language. He's using sort of super vague spirituality, which is the way he deals with his cons too. He's saying the information he's giving is as vague as possible because he's waiting for the reaction of the listener so that he can go on in the direction that makes sense.
Yeah, again, it's the least possible effort. This is a guy just like coasting his way through life on whatever's convenient, mooching off anyone around him. But what I liked is that usually in these stories, this guy will like ruin people. He will drag people down around him. But aside from Pete, who, you know, nobody forced him to drink a whole bottle of wood alcohol, everyone around him's okay. We see like Xena, the fortune teller that he's cozying up to before he, you know, to steal her code before he like ditches her and because he's guilty about accidentally killing her husband. And she's fine. She's well-dressed. She's making a living. She's going to be okay. She could even conceivably still sell that code. I mean, he can't be in every nightclub in America at once. There are other major cities besides what I believe is Chicago. You know, she could sell that code to somebody else who could go work the West Coast with it, and she'd still be fine. I liked that. And then Molly, his wife, he marries Molly. That's a weird scene we can talk about later, like the whole setup for how they get married. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're going to jump to a conclusion and neither of you are going to say anything to disprove that conclusion when you could very easily do so. he actually like does the decent thing and looks out for her and helps, gives her his last bit of money and gets her out of town.
And then she goes right back to a carnival, which I think is sort of interesting. But I guess it's what she knows. But I guess looking at Colleen Gray and seeing how her character, I always got the sense that she was probably an accidental carny. But apparently that's like, look, that's where my life is. I'm going back to the carnival. So
it's like Kristen Bell marrying Dax Shepard. Sometimes you have an extraordinarily beautiful, talented and accomplished woman who just for some reason thinks I deserve to be with the first dumb schmuck who pays me attention. And I think that's Molly's story. Some women just don't know their own worth. And I guess they just are like, Molly could do a lot of things. She's smart. She's talented. But I guess she just is not very ambitious or doesn't think enough of herself to try, which is how she ends up with Stan.
I mean, she knew initially how they got to this situation and how they got the code, and she went with him, and she keeps finding out more of, you know, well, this is a step too far. Well, maybe not. Well, this is a step too far. But she just loves him, and she's just going to go on with him as long as he'll let her. And he mistreats her in a sense, because obviously he doesn't care about her in the way that a woman would wish to be cared about, but he's not, you know, you sort of expect at some point he's going to, you know, knock her down and leave her and do terrible things to her. And he really doesn't.
No, he doesn't. Well, maybe he steps on her a little with Lilith.
Little bit.
It's not clear.
Yeah.
But yeah, he doesn't. He gaslights the heck out of her.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
I don't get the impression she is that in love with him either, though. She just seems to be kind of like, it feels like a lot of characters are just swept along by whatever is happening and their motivations are unclear. And so it doesn't feel like she's that much in love with him, but they have a good life. She's performing still. They're doing all this stuff. I just kept waiting for him to kill her, honestly, but he didn't.
I thought there would be some physical abuse or some sort of degradation that she'd have to go through. And I mean, but the way, like, they get together and they're sort of doing the ingenue thing where she's like, it seems like she's desperately in love with him and he seems to reciprocate. And then there's the whole scene where they force them to get married, even though, as Nathan says, why? And which seems like for her, she cares enough about him to allow it to happen. But yeah, I think she loves him a lot more than he loves her. But I do sort of think there is a sense in which she's like, well, this is what my life is now, and I'm going to continue going along this track because probably it was better than the track that was happening before.
He is literally the only handsome dude in the carnival. He is like the best she can settle
it's
for,
like,
and she lacks
the hottest guy in the class, right?
Right.
Yeah. She lacks the imagination or the ambition. The only other guy who was taking an interest in her was like the 50-something cauliflower-eared strongman. No offense to Mike Mazurki, who I love. Moose Malloy in Murder My Sweet Forever.
Yes.
But yeah, he's no Tyrone Power.
No. And probably just – and from a prospect, like if you're thinking of it in sort of cold, hard prospects, Tyrone Power is ambitious in a way. And he was going to get out of whatever he was in, clearly. And I think she was aware of that. And she knew that, you know, he was – you know, cheating on Xena with her and okay, we're going to get out of here together. Of course, I guess most people who end up with the person they've cheated with don't really do the math and go, you know, if he did that to her. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, there's not. Yeah, you sort of think there's going to be more of that going on, that he's just going to find another younger girl. Like one of the ways it could have gone is she could go to seed a little bit and then he's like, well, I need a new assistant. But Colleen Gray is quite young and beautiful in this movie. And so they don't have time to develop that.
Yeah, I was struck by her. I'm going to be really generous and call it a costume. when I first saw it, it was kind of like Barbara Stanwyck and the dress that's been run through the industrial shredder from Ball of Fire. And I was like, I guess this was just the thing they could do in the 1940s. But no, they specifically mention in the world of the movie, this costume is scandalous.
I love the explanation. Well, it's going to burst into flames. If she, what? I didn't. Like, what the hell? So she has to wear this costume because if she wore any more clothes made of this material, she would burst into flames.
As it is, just everyone around her bursts into flame instead.
It's like, whoo, she is hot. I did find her more like the point where she refuses. Well, she doesn't even refuse because she does act like the ghost of the rich guy's long lost love. And that's her breaking point. And, you know, but only after she breaks his heart and makes him weep and all that. It's like, oh, she does have some morals, sort of, because she seems like, I think she likes to think of herself as the good person, but she's really not any more ethical than her husband because she's helping him scam constantly. So,
well, in that scene, she's confronted with the guilt of what she's doing, right? She's seeing most of the scams they perform. You're not seeing any harm come to the victim. You're not seeing the victim actually be devastated by what you do. And she's, you know, she's like, I'm capable of feeling emotion at this old dude who's basically falling apart because he's seeing me and thinks he's the ghost, thinks I'm the ghost of his lover.
And it's about that religious bit, too, where she's just worried she's doing badly by God. So that seems to be a moral. That's a bit of moralizing right at that moment. But that's all we get.
Yeah, then there's that conversation they have where she's like, you know, is this against God? And he's like, no, he doesn't say I don't care. He's trying to convince her that what they're doing is not against God. But then there's another point in the movie where he's like, I didn't say God. So they're trying to do some religious stuff in there, but I don't think they do it very well. I don't think the script is coherent about the way they're using religion.
Yeah, it tells, it doesn't show. Mm-hmm. You never see Stan having like a cold reading with any of these rich folks, except that first time very briefly. So it really leaves a lot of that up to your imagination in an ineffective way. But I just wanted to stand up for Molly a little bit. She's supposed to be really, I think, obviously younger than Colleen Gray actually was. She's supposed to be really young, really naive. She doesn't want Stan to leave her. And he's like implying, you go along with this scam or you walk out on me. So he's kind of manipulating her and making her or encouraging her to rationalize what they're doing. And when they're in the nightclub act, they're not harming anyone. They're not picking people's pockets. People are paying their money to be entertained and they're just entertaining them. That's all. It's only when he starts grifting people with like actual consequences that she starts to worry. And you know, especially when he starts bringing in the religious angle. But again, she doesn't want him to leave her. She thinks he's the best she'll ever do. And as we'll see, you know, a smart woman when encountering him later on in the movie would have been like, hey, man, sucks to be you. Have a nice life. And instead she's like, nope, I'm going to shackle myself to this broken down wreck of a man.
Well, shall we talk about Lilith?
Oh, I was like, then there's Lilith.
Lilith is amazing.
Love her. Love Helen Walker. I've seen Helen Walker in a lot of things, but this is the one that is the most memorable, and is so surprising in what happens, because you think when they meet, he's going to scam her. Mm-hmm. They may or may not have an affair. She may or may not get her heart broken, but at the very least, he's going to scam her, and that's going to be as simple as that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, there's that. But then we find out, and I do feel like it's either, I don't know, you tell me what you think. Is it a flaw of the script, or is it just good storytelling that they go from, he tells her what he wants. He wants the records of her patients so that he can know their deepest, darkest secrets. And the next thing you know, she's a complete accomplice with him in the grift. So is that, did they skip a step, do you think, or is that good storytelling?
No, she's bent from the jump. You can tell that. There is something up with her. You don't quietly record your patient's private confidential sessions and then not tell them and keep those recordings to yourself unless you are crooked. So I believe from the jump that she was ready to do some immoral things and just waiting for the right opportunity. What floors me about Lilith is she gets away with it.
Mm-hmm.
There are no consequences for her completely evil actions. I've never seen that in an old movie. You'd expect like the police come in at the end and they're like, well, we got that Lilith gal. She was a scammer. Nope. As far as we know, she has a highly successful career with all of that stolen money.
Either that or he kills her. One of those two things has to happen. She either gets killed or she gets caught. But neither of those things happens. It's like, it's amazing. I was like, wait, I went back and I looked at it. I was like, wait, did I miss something? Nope. And yeah, right. So she has three turns. There's like the part where you're okay. She's a psychologist, and he is going to grift her. Then she becomes his completely willing accomplice, and then she turns on him in an amazing way. And I do think in that scene where he basically comes and says, and she says, "Here, let me get your money," and like she's in the scenes where they're accomplices. She's having more smart ideas than he is, to Nathan's point. Mm-hmm. He's not that smart. And she's like, here, let me make it better. Here, I'll keep the money, but not so that I can steal it from you. I'm going to tell you everything I'm doing so that you have complete confidence and faith in me. And I'm only going to cheat you at the very end once you have to get out of town, because she probably had to figure at some point he's going to have to leave town.
And she just completely rooks him. She is not in any way fazed by his threats of violence. She is just takes complete control of the situation in a way that I've never seen a woman be allowed to do in an old movie. And just takes him to the cleaners.
Well, and she gets his weakness because the way he came to see her the second time was he comes to her office and says, here, let me tell you about my sordid past, as a way to sort of ingratiate himself to her. And she uses what knowledge she gains of him, because he doesn't really lie to her. I mean, he doesn't get as explicit about Pete as her investigations end up telling her more than she knew before. But he doesn't lie to her. And she uses that knowledge of his character against him.
She's just very smart. And I love that at the end, I think nobody knows she's even been involved. So she literally just walks. She doesn't even have to move. She can sit on that money where, like, how would she have it? No one probably understands their connection and her part of the con. So she has set herself up beautifully and can, you know, probably continue doing some sort of criminal behavior and getting more scams going.
She can keep being the doctor. She can keep being the psychologist for those patients that, oh, my God, I was taken advantage of. Oh, that is terrible. Like, oh, really? Here, let me record your conversation about it.
And the money's all in cash. She never even has to let the IRS know that it exists.
She can just sit on that money and use it whenever, and really is Lilith the hero of this movie.
And I love the bit where, like, she kept some money in the safe, and enough that when he picked the envelope up, even if he checked to see if there were any greenbacks in it, he trusted her sufficiently that he was never going to count it. But she then he doesn't discover that he's been cheated until he's almost to the train station. Then he's like, hold up, hold up.
I thought it was decent of her that she put actual like $1 bills in the middle of that stack. She could have just put like green pieces of paper, but she, you know, she paid him a little something for his time and trouble.
I mean, that those days, 150 isn't like nothing.
It's a pretty good bankroll for him to give Colleen Gray a little later on.
Yeah.
His slide into alcoholism after that, though, is a little too abrupt. I mean, on the one hand, when he takes that first drink and they layer over the screams of the geek from earlier, that is chilling. And the movie could have just ended there and you would have known exactly what was going to happen. But on the other hand, it's a little like that scene in The Simpsons where they're flashing back to Homer and Barney in high school, and clean-cut Barney Gumble takes his first sip of alcohol, immediately morphs into the drunken mess that we all know and love today, and says, "It begins!" Kind of like that.
It is very abrupt, and then as I say, because Tyrone Power isn't all the actor that he could be, and because he looks like he does, that's the point at which I'm most like, I can see Tyrone Power through that. And in fact, in the first part of the, after he's drinking, and then he eventually goes to a carnival, which turns out to be the same carnival where Colleen Gray is, because there's only one apparently.
Yeah.
When he goes to get a job, you first kind of see him from a distance and from the back, and I'm thinking maybe they won't show his face, or maybe when we do see his face, it'll be a real surprise. And of course, he looks haggard, but he doesn't. But he looks like it looks like Tyrone Power. I mean, come on.
He looks like a rough Tyrone Power, though. Yeah. He looks like a Tyrone Power who's been like run through the wash on the wrong cycle about 15 times and then hung out to dry.
he does. I guess I don't know. I thought he looked a little bit too. Not quite disheveled enough for my taste. But then again, by that part of the movie, maybe I'm just bloodthirsty.
I felt like they could have moved a little faster through that, because it's like, yeah, I get it. Like, I sort of feel like the story was sort of done and could have just jumped to that last scene after he gives Molly the money. And then he could have been like, and flash forward, now we're at a carnival and now we're just going to see the last few scenes and rush it along. Because like, I get it. I get what you're doing. And that was the most predictable point of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of horrible to watch, because, again, you have that sick feeling in the pit of your stomach where you know where this is headed. And you're like, but the movie, by having those scenes in between and not just cutting to it, the movie is kind of making you, it's dangling the tiniest false hope that maybe he won't end up where you know he's going to end up.
Well, it's also kind of doing the reverse, because the hanged man card comes up when Xena comes to visit him. And so the impression you're left with is that he's going to die, right? Mm-hmm. So he's either going to have this fake ending that they put on the movie, or he's going to die in some horrible way.
I didn't care, though. But that's the thing. I was like, oh, well, whatever. He's kind of a terrible person, and I don't care if he dies.
I think, you know, what the movie does well is that even though he is a terrible person, they establish the fate that he is headed for as something so horrible that you wouldn't wish it on the worst person on earth.
Except, like, I apparently have less of a heart than you do, because I don't care.
I can think of certain prominent politicians who I would not want to end up, you know, in that position as a geek at a sideshow.
Well, and it is interesting, because they do start out basically, even in the Carney world, the plight of the geek for most of the people who are there is reprehensible. Nobody likes that the geek is there. Obviously, the person who is the geek is taken advantage of and has a terrible, terrible life. But I remember watching this for the first time and thinking, oh, well, instead of just sort of matter-of-factly saying, oh, there's a geek and that's just his lot in life, the people do sort of pause to go, yeah, that's a terrible, terrible life to have to live. And so eventually when Tyrone Power reaches that level, I think that's the payoff of it. It's like everybody agrees that that's no way to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when carnies are looking down on you, you have sunk as low as you can possibly go.
I do think the fact that, and I think the rushed part was once he gets to the carnival, and then it's like that very evening that the geek is freaking out and you just see him yelling and screaming, and it seems incongruous. It doesn't seem to have to do with anything other than obviously he's been drinking all day, but it doesn't seem connected to anything. It's not like, I mean, unless they didn't have him have a flashback, they didn't have people taunt him, there doesn't seem to be any specific reason that he kind of lost his marbles in that moment, so to speak.
I could see it as like he not sobered up, but drunked up enough to realize what a bad spot he was in and was like desperately trying to escape. And it is creepy that like they are trying to force him to remain with them instead of being like, okay, we're just out a bottle of liquor. No big harm done. We will not keep a man prisoner and force him to bite the heads off chickens. Right. And instead they're like, nope, get back in your cage. Yeah. That was unsettling. And I love that. So, I mean, the ending where, you know, he is offered the position of the geek and just gives that sickly smile and says, Mr. I was made for it. Again, perfect place to stop the movie.
Yeah.
And I knew that was like, that was the original ending. And then everything that came after was tacked on. But what comes after is so much more evil because he becomes Pete. Mm-hmm. And worse yet, Molly becomes Xena. They get trapped in this eternal cycle. Sooner or later, Molly's going to, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, he's going to be a doddering wreck that Molly's shackled to. She's going to meet some hunky young dude and it's going to start all over again. And that was so quietly bleak and such a diabolical way to subvert. Oh, it's a happy ending that I really liked it. I found it when I stopped and thought about it, it was even more chilling than what would have been the original ending, I thought.
When you think of it that way, it does work. Like if you just see it for what it is on the screen, it's disappointing. And it's like, really? Really? So he gets Molly to sort of take care of him. But you're absolutely right that the point is, and there's plenty of parallelism in this movie to say, you know, this is what happened before, this is what's going to happen again. So yeah, if you think about it for a minute, you're absolutely right. He's going to end up being Pete. He's going to end up, you know, using euphemisms to get Molly to give him a couple of bucks so he can get a bottle, and on it'll go until their lives end.
Well, and doesn't Xena say at some point earlier in the movie that Pete would be the geek, except for she's there to take care of him? So that is like exactly the same situation mm-hmm. that they're in, tying it further.
And he'll have those awful, heartbreaking flashes of you know, the man he used to be, just like Pete does, before sinking back into the DTs.
Right. And Molly is there to sort of remind people of his history to the whether she wants to or not. And he'll say things that'll, you know, back when I was in the nightclub in Chicago and we were raking it in or whatever. And there's always going to be sort of, oh, he's talking about the old times again, but nobody's going to understand half of what he says. And yeah.
Yep.
And someday Molly will sell the code. And yeah.
Yeah. Molly still has the code. So I don't know what she's doing with it, but she could presumably continue to use it. That's the thing. Anybody, you don't even have to go to another nightclub. Anybody at the carnival can continue using the code. And the code, mm-hmm. of course, by the way, we just have to say it's ridiculous. We're supposed to believe that the tone of her voice gives all of this detailed information about the code. And she's not actress enough to even make that credible. And there certainly is not enough. There's not enough variation and not enough words that she's saying for such a code to exist. I realize I'm overthinking it, but I can't help it. That's who I am.
Oh,
I still thought it was interesting that they laid out there is a code. These are the principles on which the code works. I like that there was like just a dash of like process and anthropology to this movie. It wasn't just this is a story at a carnival. It was we're going to show you a little something about how carnival people live, how these systems work, et cetera, et cetera. That always fascinates
me. I did like
me.
It. And then I started trying to parse out not the code itself, but whether it could work or not. And
I think it does work because I think that people did do that sort of thing. It's just the thing that's sort of funny to me is that, well, you could just make your own code. You don't need a particular code, right? Like if you and I decide right. we want to go off and do some sort of scam and like all we need to do is make our own code, we don't need a particular code.
Yeah, the advantage that their code has is that it exists. It has a grammar.
Yes.
And once one person teaches it to another, then two of them know. Because in order to create a new code, two of you have to agree on it.
Yep.
And as, you know, back to the point of Tyrone Power not being all that bright, well, it's much easier
it's
to
true.
Take somebody else's code than it is to come up with your own.
Exactly. Stan was never going to make his own code. Neither was Molly.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, Molly lacks the ambition and Stan lacks the brains.
Molly was just never, like, have the creativity to think of it. Well, neither would Stan. They're just, you know.
Well, I mean, that's why the code has value, because somebody else yeah. made it. Like I say, it has those elements that require somebody to sit down and have thought of it, which is why, you know, if you think back about it, so Pete, you know, was once a formidable enough person that he came up with that code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Poor Pete. Poor Pete. Zena.
Yeah, Pete really tugs at your heartstrings. I mean, he's kind of awful, but he's so pathetic that you feel bad for him. It's weird to have a movie where Mike Mazurki's in it and he's not the biggest object of pity.
No, he's just really tall. Yeah, Mike Mazurki, for those of you who are not noir aficionados, he's often the heavy, whether he be a mobster or whether he be a crazed ex-lover, whatever. But because he's a big, physically imposing presence and is great for a carnival movie for that reason. But yeah, he's not the most terrifying human in the movie by any means.
Yeah, you look up Big Dumb Galoot in the dictionary and there's a picture of Mike Mazurki there.
He looks like he would not have any trouble biting the heads off chickens.
I looked at his IMDb page and man, that dude played so many cavemen in his later years.
Aww. Yeah, I guess say maybe I shouldn't. That's probably not a good thing, but yeah. You do what you're able to do, right? You got to earn a living.
Yep.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Murder, My Sweet, the incongruously great adaptation of Raymond Chandler's The High Window, where Dick Powell plays Philip Marlowe and plays him surprisingly well. Mike Mazurki is beautifully cast as the central, doomed, tragic, big, dumb galoot in that story, and he does just a fantastic job.
I really, by the way, like Dick Powell in his, that is the beginning of his, oh, I'm not a song and dance leading man anymore because I'm past 40 and I'm going to be a noir actor and director. And I really like Dick Powell and would recommend Murder, My Sweet. And there are half a dozen other really, and I in old movie circles, there are people who, I think that's like a bright line for people. Some people are like, Dick Powell, what are you even talking about? And other people kind of get him and, We'll find a Dick Powell to watch, but he's delightful because as a noir protagonist, he has a little bit of a humor and a glint in his eye that, say, a Bogart might not. And nothing against Bogart, but and that's just because that's the first example that came to my mind. Mm-hmm. But there's just something winning and twinkly about Dick Powell that I enjoy.
And I can't say the same for Tyrone Power in this movie.
No.
I really enjoy The Mark of Zorro. It's fun. He's got great chemistry with Linda Darnell. Holy
yes.
Hannah, that final sword fight with, I want to say, Basil Rathbone. Just incredible stuff. And here he's okay. There, like I said, there's like one or two scenes where he does some good face acting. But mostly he's just like, hi, I'm handsome. I'm in a tight shirt. I'm going to say some lines now. That cool with you? Cool. Let's do it.
There is a place for that, to be fair.
Oh, he is very handsome man. He wears a tight t-shirt very well. I've never looked as good in my life as Tyrone Power does here, and I never will. There's not a lot going on behind that performance. And it's sad that this was like his favorite performance. He even had a plane that he named The Geek after this movie.
I appreciate that he wanted to do it. And I think he was trying. I think he was doing his best. And I'm glad he did it. I think it's interesting to have because, yeah, you could cast somebody else in that part who would objectively be a better actor. But he's interesting to watch. And I think because he's so attractive and because it's Tyrone Power and people in that era would have known him for different things, he becomes more magnetic than his acting otherwise makes him. Because I think there does need to be some magnetism in that character, especially with a script where some of the things that he says don't actually make that much sense.
Oh, he is. I give him all the credit in the world for being like, I'm going to torpedo my image to play the sleaziest, most depraved character. I love that he had the guts and that he wanted to make this. I'm not sure his talents were quite equal to the material, but the material is so good that it kind of lifts him up.
Yeah.
And Joan Blondell.
Oh, she's great. I love her in this. Of course, what have I seen that I don't love Joan Blondell in? But I just love her career because she worked up until like 1970 or something. And she did so well at moving through the stages of life. You know, as women age, we don't get to do the things that we would like to have done. But mm-hmm. she gets great parts, and she is in a position where she's taking supporting roles, and she's not a harridan or a dowager. I mean, she's delightful. And I really enjoyed watching her. And of course, you have a lot of sympathy for her because Tyrone Power does her dirty. But I think as a character, she holds up. I really like the scene when she and Mike Mazurki come to see Molly and Stan in the hotel. I like the way she handles it. I like the way she puts him off a little bit by saying, oh, well, let's, you know, forgive, you know, kiss and make up, basically. And he's like, wait, is this for real? And I just like the way she handles it because she kind of holds him at arm's length and doesn't, until we get to the cards, she doesn't really show her cards at the beginning. And I enjoy that.
I didn't read that card reading as revenge. I read it as her being completely sincere and like trying to warn him.
Yeah.
I like that she's not playing a role. She's playing a person.
I think she was trying to warn him. I guess what I'm saying is just like in the beginning, I think that what she said, whatever her motives were, I felt like she put Stan off a little bit because he's expecting something different than he gets from her, both in the beginning and when the card reading happens, which makes him super nervous because, again, he may be amoral and he may not believe his own bull, but he's a little superstitious.
Mm-hmm. And it's even better to see him sweat when she has no agenda. He's so paranoid. It's good. It's revealing of his character that she comes in with no agenda, genuinely willing to forgive and forget. And he is just so paranoid that he can't deal with it. And that says a lot about how guilty he feels, that we can see clearly she's not trying to needle him or set him up or anything. She's just doing the kind human thing. And he's reacting to it in that particular way.
Well, and it just is so interesting that someone who is such a scam artist still is superstitious, which just adds an interesting dimension to his character. And I think you're right. It comes out of guilt more than faith. Also mistrust of people because you can't trust him. Therefore, he can trust no one.
Yeah. And he talks about how he loves to like know more than all the suckers out there. And that speaks to an insecurity in his character, yeah. Like that the movie exploits well.
Well, and the backstory, which is not an uncommon backstory for a character like this, is he was an orphan and he was mistreated in the orphanage, and so he learned mistrust at a young age,
mm-hmm.
and that's paid forward. And I think they did the right amount of exposition there. I don't think you even had to do that, but I think it's useful because you can sort of think about him as a sympathetic character who was abused as a child and turned inward and basically says, well, I'm never going to give a sucker an even break, and I'm always going to come out on top because he's got the gift of gab, whether he has intelligence or not, but he has the ability to sway people with both his looks and his words.
And it's interesting that the cinematography here is just gorgeous.
It is.
And it's by a guy named Lee Garms. And I'm looking through his filmography and he worked steadily for a long time. But I don't recognize a darn thing in this except, you know, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Maybe Duel in the Sun. Maybe I've sort of heard of.
Duel in the Sun is a great and it's a beautiful movie. I think that this movie benefits from being at 20th Century Fox and Tyrone Power being the big star on the lot because they did apply production values to what is a gritty movie. And if it had been made at RKO or if it had been made at Monogram or somewhere, it wouldn't have looked even. Well, I guess I should say you still might have had a great director dealing with a low budget. But this feels like it was. You know, he had a little room. The director had a little room to play around with.
Yep.
Really good.
They built a whole carnival on the backlot and hired like 100 different actual carnival performers. So they were not messing around on the budget mm-hmm. for this thing.
And it did very badly. Did not. And whether it was people not wanting to see Tyrone Power in that kind of role, or for whatever reason, it flopped pretty good.
People don't like it when they typecast someone, letting someone be not the typecast.
Yeah, it's true. And well, I think especially when you've got somebody like if you say Tyrone Power or Errol Flynn or Clark Gable, I was trying to think of a woman to put in that box. But you have somebody who's known for a certain kind of Myrna Loy would come to mind, who's known for a certain kind of character. and then you take them other places. It's like, to me, it's like the person who likes a band and who gets angry when they go to the show and they don't play the hits. Mm-hmm. And I'm the person going, oh, you have a new song? Cool, I want to hear it. Because I'm a nerd like that. But that's not the way people go to movies. People are like, Tyrone Power, I want to see him swashbuckling and I want to see him kissing Linda Darnell because both of them are really pretty.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that. But also, you know, it's hard for someone if they can't step out of the box ever. So,
well, and if you're Tyrone Power, I mean, think about it. You have all this power, right? You are the guy at the studio. Why not flex it a little bit? And you're even saying to yourself, I don't know if this is going to work, but let me take a risk. Let me do something a little different. I think that's a good use of his capital at the studio.
Yeah. And so what if it flopped? So, okay, they're out a little money. He will make it back by just going back to making the other movies. Let him try something. Let him experiment. It's hilarious to me now because I can finally see why Tyrone Power looks so weirdly familiar to me. It's because he looks like handsome Charles Boyle from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Joe Latruglio. If you go back and look at him and then look at Joe Latruglio, it's eerie and kind of hilarious.
It's good to look like Tyrone Power.
Certainly doesn't hurt.
Something we found out when we were looking at the IMDb for this movie is that there is in fact a remake happening, and it is going to be released later this year in December. And I don't know much about it other than Cate Blanchett stars in the Helen Walker role, and
She's going to be the Lilith Ritter, and I'm like, yes. That feels really, really well.
I love the hell out of it. I want to see that.
Yeah, I was like, that casting in itself makes me super happy.
That's how I knew Lilith was going to be a badass in this movie, because I accidentally looked up the remake first and I'm like, okay, so Blanchett's playing that role. That lady's going to be dangerous. And Rooney Mara as Molly, Bradley Cooper as Stanton Carlisle.
Toni Collette as Xena.
Yeah.
Going to be great.
Ron Perlman as Bruno, which is like, yeah, of course. Oh.
Yeah. So, no plans as of yet, but if you're an incomparable member, I would watch your feeds later this year because maybe we'll have a little something special for you. If you're not, you should become an incomparable member so that you'll know what I'm talking about. Anything else we want to say about the 1947 Nightmare Alley before we push on?
I'm glad I saw it. It is visually gorgeous. It is a compelling story that only rarely drags. And it is just amazing to see Helen Walker completely rook and walk all over our quote-unquote hero and get away with it. Plus, Colleen Gray, yowza. That's all I got to say.
I just like that it starts out where you think it's so predictable, and then it takes you in a direction where I didn't know what was happening. And that was really fun to me because, like, literally the whole movie, I'm like, well, when's the murder happening? So, yes, apparently I have a thing for murder mysteries, which now Shelley knows. Yes. But I also I said to Shelley, well, also now I'm going to be like super smug when that new movie comes out. I'm like, well, in the original, and I'm just really excited to be so smug about it.
People love that, by the way.
Yes, I know. I'm going to make so many friends.
I know.
It is really interesting that we've got a noir movie where the main character only ruins his own life. Usually in noir, you know, you've got a movie where the character ruins like everybody's lives around them. Here, it's interesting that he is the only one whose life he torpedoes, unless you count Molly, who should have known better. I don't blame him for that. That was all on her.
I tend to agree. Agreed. Yeah, Nightmare Alley, a lot of fun, and one that I saw fairly recently in my journey as a classic film fan and as somebody who sort of lives in this world. It was surprising even to me, especially Helen Walker. I think the first time I ever encountered it, I saw a clip, which is the scene when Helen Walker and Tyrone Power meet, and even in that, not in the nightclub, but in her office. And I remember thinking, even in that scene, wow, this is going to be a really different movie because of all the reasons Nathan said. And, you know, remember, like, not only is Helen Walker as a woman getting to do very unusual things, but she's getting to do them against a typical dashing leading man who almost always has women, you know, swooning at his feet. Mm-hmm. So yay for that. And Helen Walker was 27 when she made this movie. So there you go. I know, yeah. Right? Well, Annette Wurster, Nathan Alderman, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Nightmare Alley. It was really a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. I guess I got to get back in my cage now. There's another show coming up in 10 minutes.
Chicken. Next time on Lions, Towers, and Shields, we'll be talking about a very different movie. We're going back to the pre-code era for Night Nurse. It's the Nights of August or something. What did I say before? I forget what I said. Anyway, never mind. Next time on Lions, Towers, and Shields, we'll talk about the pre-code wonder that is Night Nurse. Yes, we're going back to Barbara Stanwyck land and 1931. We'll see you for that in 2 weeks. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra, or you can go to theincomparable.com/LTS and subscribe and also become a member. Bye now.